Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. It's Monday, October 10th. Holy moly. Time is just screaming by. Cindy and I are still on the road, so if you notice, there was no intro music and there will be no exit music. That's all on our computer back at home, and I can't get to it. But I will do my best in giving you what I've got for today's podcast. Kai's not with me. She's back in Ohio, holding down the fort, maintaining the fortress of ultimate Quakerdom, keeping the animals fed and all the critters happy. So we're still here in Missouri on the road, as I said, taking care of the family issues that we've been dealing with. And hopefully we can get this all in control and get back to normal lives real soon. In the meantime, there's one of the things I wanted to go over is there's these videos that are suddenly popping up all over the internet of these really weird meetings of the Occupy folks, you know, the Occupy DC, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy whatever. They're starting to have meetings, and these meetings may strike, well, if you haven't seen one, you got to see one. I'll put a link to one. There's quite a few of them floating around, but I'll put a link to one of them on the webpage at badquaker.com where this podcast appears. But if you're unfamiliar with the particular type of, what do you call it? It's a method of conducting a meeting that they're going about using. If you're unfamiliar with it, it looks bizarre at best, cultish a little. Yeah. It's not really. It's kind of an effective method of speaking when you have a large group of people and you don't have the capacity to individually microphone everyone, so you need to get it across to everybody what's being said. But just to watch it take place, especially with a circle of somewhat hippie-looking people in a public park, it really looks weird. But anyway, I wanted to go over some things, and I wanted to touch that as well as we look at, again, as I've been pushing recently, look past what you're being shown. See past the image that's being presented to you and see what it is at the root of what you're looking at so that you can honestly evaluate what the product is that's being sold to you, if you A, know a product is being sold to you, B, can recognize what the product is, C, understand the price. And once you start to begin to see these things, then you can decide, do I want this? Is this something I want? Okay, so first off, before we get to, before we separate out the Occupy folks, let's develop the groundwork of why we libertarians, specifically anarcho-capitalists, refer to self-ownership as being such an important factor in the basis for understanding property rights and for the basis in understanding what the zero aggression principle is and why it's so important. So first off, let's go through a couple things. You may or may not have heard the phrase popular sovereignty. As a matter of fact, you may or may not have heard any of these concepts with the specific names that I'm going to give them, but I'm sure you're familiar with each of the concepts, even if you're not familiar with the specific terminology that I use. But the first one that I'm going to talk about is commonly referred to as popular sovereignty, or sometimes it's called sovereignty of the people. You can get a pretty good idea of this one if you just do a Wikipedia search on popular sovereignty. But to spare boring you by just reading Wikipedia, let me just kind of give you the idea that popular sovereignty is the concept that the legitimacy of the state is based on the consent of the ruled or the consent of the people. This was essentially what Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, even Benjamin Franklin supported this concept in writings. The idea that Well, let's quote, Wikipedia actually quotes Franklin, so let's read Franklin's quote. In free governments, the rulers are the servants, and the people, their superiors and sovereigns. Okay, so the concept is that, as Franklin says, in a free government, not quite sure how he would define a free government, but let's go beyond that. The rulers are the servants, and the people, their superiors and sovereigns. Now, this is the kind of thing that when Franklin would write stuff like that, and then the French would hear it, and they would just get all giggly over it. But I'm sorry, you know, sometimes, well, what was it Murray Rothbard called Franklin? I wish I could remember that. I wish I was at home. If I was at home on my computer at home, I could find this really quick, because I've got, I would just pull up Conceived in Liberty and start doing word searches until I found it, but I can't, so now I'm stuck half-quoting Rothbard and half-attacking Franklin. But it was something to the, opportunist, perhaps? That old opportunist? Maybe, that might have been what it was. Don't hold me on that, but the concept is similar. In other words, Franklin and Rothbard didn't specifically lay this out, but you can read it between the lines in Conceived in Liberty. Rothbard basically said, you know, Franklin was kind of like anytime a dime hit the ground, he would be the first to dive on it. Anytime the latest movement was going in a particular direction, oddly enough, that's the way Franklin was going. Whoever was going to be the winners of the moment, Franklin was right there with them. When it seemed popular to not want to separate from England, and it seemed popular to just get concessions from Parliament so that the burden would be lighter in the colonies, Franklin was your man. He was right there. He's going to England and talking to Parliament, trying to get that to be set. And when the time comes that it looks like the popular emotion is that, hey, we're going to be separating, we're going to be looking for war, there's Franklin right in the midst of it. And when it's time to form a Continental Congress, hey, Franklin's right with you. And then when it's time to dump the Continental Congress, when it's time to form a Articles of Confederacy, Franklin's right there. Yeah, that's the way to go. And then as soon as it's time to dump the Articles of Confederation, which, despite what, you know, state-run schools tell us over and over and over, the Articles of Confederation were working perfectly. They just weren't filling Washington and Alexander Hamilton and Hamilton's banker buddies' pockets with piles of cash. So because Alexander Hamilton's banker supporters were not able to cash in on the situation, there was a need to dump the Articles of Confederation and bring in a constitutional government and bring in a stronger federal state to lord over the lesser states. And what do you know? There's Franklin. Madam, you've got a republic if you can keep it. That's like saying, here's a handful of warm jello. Hang on to it. Okay, but anyway, no Franklin bashing beyond that. That's my whole Franklin attack. So, according to Franklin here, quoted in Wikipedia, in free governments, the rulers are the servants and the people their superiors and sovereigns. Really? Wow. I wonder when the last time Nancy Pelosi or John Bonner bowed to their sovereign and acknowledged their sovereign, you know, the voter. I wonder when the last time that was, when they acknowledged the sovereignty of the individual and acknowledged their superiors, the people. Doesn't that just smack of pure communism to you? And that's Franklin. That's at or around 100 years before Marx and Engels were typing out their little, I don't even know if they had a typewriter. They may have manually written that stuff. Anyway, it's clearly, we're bordering a type of socialism here, and specifically moving towards a communist-type socialism when we start talking about the servant, about the government being the servants, the rulers being the servants of the people, and the people being the superiors and the sovereigns. This is fantasy utopia stuff that just never works. It always makes the voters feel like he's really, really important. But in the long run, it's not, you know, the voter doesn't call out the cops to a session of Congress and have the cops pepper spray and beat down Congress because they're not getting accomplished whatever it is that the voter wants. That doesn't happen. And yet when the voters go and they march on a particular, like the guys in the Occupy Wall Street thing, you really think that they, or even, let's go back to Franklin's day. Let's go back to a time when Franklin was alive and walking on the planet. And when Shay's Rebellion came up and people said, you know what, we're not going to pay these ridiculous taxes. We're not going to pay this property tax. We're not going to, let's look up Shay's Rebellion, shall we? Shay's Rebellion. So in Shay's Rebellion, right in that same time frame, this was slightly before the new Federalist government came in under the Constitution, but the problem was still the same. You had individuals who were facing governmental authorities and business authorities, sort of a little fascist. Of a hint to the future fascism that would come upon the nation. You had individuals and in business and individuals in the government as it existed that were putting pressure on others to pay debts in hard species, in gold and silver, at a time when there was a shortage. And this was bring about a financial crisis. Specifically, it was worse in the Massachusetts area where Shay himself was. Shay being a Daniel Shay, a hero of the War of Independence, and he reluctantly took up arms and went into the crisis on the side of individuals that were fighting this debt collection and these essentially what were, in a way, taxation. But anyway, so the idea of popular sovereignty that Franklin was espousing didn't exist in the actual outworkings of the new governments that were being formed right after the War of Independence. It simply wasn't there. It's a fantasy. It's something you dream of, or you say, oh, can't it be like this? But in fact, no matter what eloquent words that Hobbes wrote about it, or no matter how well John Locke laid out the concept of it, the fact of the matter is when this once you have a state, the idea that the state could ever be legitimate is a problem. And then the idea that the people give consent to the state is confusing at best, laughable at worst. To accept this idea that this concept, the people, like the people, like it's one entity, and they think and they move as one, and whatever the will of the people is this united thing that we can determine. Oh, it's the will of the people. Therefore, the consent of the people gives the state legitimacy. Well, we have a problem there when you start talking about the consent of the people. How many of the people? If you have 100 people, how many of those 100 people does it take to consent to having an authority over them that is given the right to use aggressive violence, theft, and lies to manage itself, to maintain its position, which is what the state is. The state is always aggressive violence, theft, and lies. That's what the state is. So the idea that if you have 100 people, and how many does it take to consent to the state to make the state legitimate? If 50%, 51 of the 100 So we have an election of 51 of the 100 say, yes, we want the state's fist to be over us. We want the states, we want aggression, we want taxation, theft, we want a distortion of the truth so that the state can stay in power. This is what we want. And so 51% of the people say this. Well, then it's just 51% of the people robbing 49%. It's still, you have 49 people being robbed by 51. Might does not make right. Just because there's more gangsters than there are shopkeepers, does that mean that it's legitimate for the gangsters to rob the shopkeeper? If there's two muggers and you're walking down the street and the two muggers approach you and they say, give me your wallet, will you say, oh no, I've got a 2/3 majority against me. They have the right to my wallet. Well, of course, no sane person would make any of these arguments because they're ridiculous. And yet, we accept this idea of the consent of the people, this sovereignty of the people, the popular sovereignty, to hand legitimacy to a state, which is simply the use of aggressive violence within a geographic area, and the use of theft, and the use of lies to maintain its monopoly on aggressive violence. So you have the state that is based on aggressive violence that uses theft and lies to continue in a continuous loop to continue its monopoly on violence, on aggressive violence. And so we're told that a consent of the people makes that legitimate. So what percentage, how many of those 100? If 90 of the 100, if the guy walking down the street is all of a sudden, if he and 9 of his friends are walking down the street and a gang of 90 approach and surround them and they are all armed and the 90 tell the 10, we want your money, we want half your money, we want a third of your money, we want 10% of your money, we want $1 from each of you. It doesn't matter the amount. Are you less robbed if the robber takes less of your money? So let's go off on that rant for a second. Let's put ourselves back on the street. There's one person walking down the street. There are two robbers. They step in front of you. The two robbers say, we're going to rob you. We have a majority. We have the consent of the people to rob you. We have a 2/3 majority. That'll pretty much put anything through any parliamentary body, a 2/3 majority. Okay, 2/3 majority is here to rob you. Two guys against you. Now, they say, well, let's check and see what you have in your wallet. And you open your wallet, and you got a little bit of cash in there, and you got a couple credit cards, and maybe you got a stashed $20 bill hidden in the back somewhere. And so they look it all over. And they decide, okay, we're gonna take this much money from you. We're gonna leave this much money with you. Wait a minute, let me see that ring you're wearing. That's a nice ring. I think we'll leave that ring with you, but we're gonna have to take your watch. Now, you know, those are nice shoes. How about those shoes? And the two robbers talk to each other. I have shoes already. Well, I like those shoes. Okay, let's take the shoes. So they take your shoes, but you know what? They don't take your coat. They leave your coat. And so you're standing there, and you've had a 2/3 majority just decided that they can take your shoes, they can take your watch, they left you a ring, they left your coat, they took part of your money out of your wallet. Are you less robbed? Really, are you less robbed? Of course not. What sane person would make this argument? That because they had a 2/3 majority and because they didn't take everything, you are not robbed somehow? How can this be an argument? And yet that's the essence of the idea of popular sovereignty and the consent of the people. What if it's 99-1? What if you are walking down the street and forget about 9 of your friends with you? Let's just say you're walking down the street and you walk into the wrong neighborhood of a rough town and all of a sudden there are 99 people surrounding you. And they've all got gang logos on, or they've all got the gang colors, or they've all got some kind of indication that they're gang members. And they're all in the same gang, and there's 99 of them, and there's one of you. Are you less robbed because there's 99 instead of a one-on-one robbery? If they take 20% of your wealth, or if they take 5% of your wealth, or if they take 2% of your wealth, but the way they take it is through aggressive force, are you less robbed? Are you not still humiliated, overwhelmed, dominated, and robbed because they left part of it, and because it was 99, a vote of 99 to 1. Hey, we had a vote, 99 to 1. So, therefore, there can be no legitimacy to popular sovereignty, the idea that the state has the consent of the people, because you can't determine what the consent of the people is unless you have 100% consent. Well, what are the odds of that? What are the odds of getting 100 people, or 100% of any particular group of people, of made up of, you know, any decent body, any decent sized body of people? What are the odds of getting 100% of them to agree to anything? In the middle of a sunny day, in the middle of a town square, in the middle of a sunny day, and you got 5,000 people, what are the odds that you can get all 5,000 people to vote yes? Indeed, it is a sunny day. I mean, you're going to have some people among them who are delusional and are going to say, no, it's not a sunny day, it's a fruit snack. So how can you have ever the consent of the people to provide a legitimacy for the state? All right, so enough beating that horse. Hopefully we can get past that one. So then how, if the state cannot be logically defended using the concept of popular sovereignty, then how can the state be how can the state be logically defended? Well, the oldest way is called the divine right of kings. This was not so much, it came and went in England's history. It was never really accepted all that well in North America, even on the West Coast, where they were under the Spanish king for a while and under the Mexican emperor for a while. The idea of divine right of kings rarely works in a very large geographic area. In order for it to work well, you have to have the king as an obvious figurehead where the people can see that king or whatever, it could be a queen or it can be whatever. But the individual head of state has to be in a position where the public can see them regularly and just be amazed by their greatness and adore them. And this is usually brought on by lots of propaganda and a lot of imagery, usually associating the head of state with a deity or as a deity, glorifying the individual as something other than human. Because when you try to use divine right of kings, and the king just looks like every other bozo in the kingdom, it's really difficult to support this idea that somehow God or the gods have taken this individual who's pretty much like everybody else and somehow made him king over everybody else. So in order to support this idea, you have to glorify the sovereign to the point of deification in order for it to work successfully. Now, if you think about in France, the method for doing this, like in the time of Louis the 14th and so forth, where the splendor of the throne was just so magnificent that individuals looking would say, wow, look at that. And it was just amazing and everything like that. And yet, even then, there were many people in France that were looking at that guy going, you know, he chews food with the same set of teeth just like me. He puts his pants on like I do. He lives and he dies just like everybody else. How is he more important than anyone else? How can he be God's representative on earth when I'm, you know, living like I am? So even then it didn't work that well. But there were, in France in that time, there were some of the components that are required, like this opulent splendor that was piled upon the kings. England attempted that in a few cases. Henry VIII made a lot of efforts to emulate what he saw on the continent. But England could never really pull that scam off like some other countries did. If you go into Southeast Asia, there were some very successful attempts at deifying the sovereign. Even today, if you go to a place like Thailand, there's still quite a bit of deification of the king in Thailand. It's to me, it's fairly comical, but a lot of people in Thailand take it very, very seriously, and it's against the law to speak ill of the king. And there was a real famous case not long ago of an American who was prosecuted under that circumstances. But anyway, of course, that we are very familiar with the situation in Japan prior to World War II, where the Emperor of Japan was deified, and yet there was this separation between recognizing the deification of the emperor and the warlords that actually ran the government. So that was kind of a weird disconnect there that maybe is an exception to some of the rules. But either way, I can say that most people, when they really think about the concept of the divine right of kings, will just dismiss it because it's just goofy. Okay, so it wasn't hard. If you're only selling the divine right of kings or popular sovereignty, if that's your only choices, which in the case of Locke, that was the only thing that he had really thought through and saw. If that's your choices, then you can see why somebody would say, well, the divine right of kings is goofy. Yeah, let's go with popular sovereignty. That seems to make more sense than the divine right of kings. But as we saw a second ago, it gets down to the same point where how is this different than theft? Just because you've got several people in your gang and I don't have that many people in my gang? Okay, so then this, when we think about, let's jump back to this vote thing, because now we're talking about democracy and the majority rule. So if we talk about democracy and majority rule, it's very few people will make the argument that a true open democracy is a good government. Very few people will try to make that argument. So I'm not even going to try to debunk that, because that's pretty easy to see through that when you have a democracy, what you end up with is a minority that just gets trampled or worse. So a lot of people, you know, already understand that a true democracy is a pretty much failure right from the start. Now, this takes us to the weird thing that we saw in those videos with the Occupy DC people and the Occupy Wall Street and these other Occupy Atlanta. There's one of the group in Occupy Atlanta that's really creepy to watch. But anyway, what you're actually seeing in those videos of the Occupy folks is called a consensus democracy. Now, this the weird repetitive chanting, or it's not really chanting, it's just a weird where one person says something and then everybody repeats it. That kind of reminded me of something that happens in a lot of old-timey churches where you have a song leader and you don't have, either the church is very poor and they don't have actual hymnals or written sheets of music for the congregation to refer to, or in the case of many of the old-timey churches, the greater of the population of the church didn't actually know how to read, so even if they had hymnals, it would have been a waste for them. So what you had in these old-timey churches, especially in the South and in Appalachia and some even down into the Deep South and some of the churches down in there, all the way up into the Ozarks, you see this where the song leader would begin the song and he would say before the song, you know, before the actual music part of the song, he would say the line of the song. For instance, he would say like, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound." And then they would all sing together, "Amazing Grace." And then he would say the next line of the song, and then they would all sing it together. And he would say it in a real rapid succession like that, like the way that, like, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound," and then "Amazing." And then they would typically sing that part of the song really slow and then pause the tune. Well, the guy whips out the next line super fast. It's bizarre to hear if you've never heard it before. But it's essentially a utilitarian way of overcoming the problem of not having hymnals or not being able to have everyone read or not having the microphone capabilities to give everyone the proper sound. So that's that weird repetition thing that you were seeing with the Occupy folks in those videos. But the point that I'm trying to get to is when they actually began deliberating and trying to establish, were they going to let this person speak, or were they going to let that person speak, or are they going to let this person film them, or are they not going to let this person film them? And these questions that they were being faced with like this, are we going to embrace civil disobedience? Are we going to embrace violence? These things are being debated by these Occupy people, and their method of debate it was really striking people odd on the internet who had never seen this before. But again, that's called consensus democracy. It's the concept that you need more than just a simple majority. You have to have the consensus of the people. So if we just pop over and look up consensus democracy in Wikipedia, they have a pretty good little explanation of it. I'm going to just read part of it. Consensus democracy is the application of consensus decision-making to the process of legislation in a democracy. It is characterized by a decision-making structure which involves and takes into account as broad range of opinions as possible as opposed to systems where minority opinions can potentially be ignored by vote-winning majorities. Okay, and then in the examples of a consensus democracy is Switzerland, Lebanon, Sweden, Iraq, and Belgium. And then there's some other examples listed. For instance, in Canada, the Northwest Territories and some others are also listed as having their government under that circumstances. So that's what you're seeing with that weird vote. But again, this consensus democracy, how can you ever have a consensus where one group of people is robbing the other group of people? I mean, you can only get, if we think of the tax feeders and the taxpayers, the proportion can only get to a certain level until the thing reverses itself and there's nothing more to feed upon, and the taxpayers are all starved away, and the tax feeders have nothing else. There's no host left for them to drain. So I suppose my problem with a consensus democracy is in a couple of ways. First off, you're still not going to come to, unless you absolutely say, okay, if no 100% consensus can be found, then this act, whatever the act or law or whatever, cannot continue. Well, again, where do you draw that line if you have 1,000 people in a park all looking at the sky on a sunny day, and you say, we all agree it's a sunny day, and one guy there is going, no, it's a banana peel. I mean, how do you deal with somebody like that? Do you just disregard them and say, well, they're crazy, so their vote doesn't count? Well, that's real convenient, because then anybody who doesn't agree can easily be considered crazy. Because, you know, that one guy who says that we shouldn't put the tax rate at this, well, he's just crazy. Well, then we can disregard him, see? Once you start disregarding individuals out of the loop and using whatever excuse you want, then the tyranny of democracy begins to edge its way in a little at a time until eventually those minorities, even though they may only be a minority of one, are trampled, and the will of the people, the people, which is the democracy, which is the bigger gang, which is, you know, the larger group of thieves as opposed to you and your smaller group, that larger group of thieves ultimately wins. So, in the long run, the consensus democracy, as much fun as it is to watch in those weird meetings, actually has no more legitimacy to a regular democracy, which is just a 50% margin. Because, again, how is 51% not, If 51% is not legitimate, can 52% be legitimate, or 53, or 56, or 76, or 96? If the idea that a majority, if it takes more than a majority, how much more? If it takes 100% consensus, then you never do anything. Now, there is an advantage to a consensus democracy if it requires 100% consensus. And that would be that the government would be entirely toothless and incapable of doing anything because it could never agree on anything, and therefore it could never act. That might have some advantages. I'm not sure that kind of a thing could take down our current so-called popular sovereignty that our current state relies upon, even though that's an illusion. So this has to take us back again to how important is the individual. Well, let's not go in the direction of Rand and some of the others that practically deify the individual and say you shouldn't help anyone else, or you shouldn't, you're under no obligation whatsoever to help anybody else or to look to anyone else, and you only think of yourself. Well, here's the difference. Let's take the story of that Jesus told of the parable of the Good Samaritan. So we have the traveler walking down the road, and he gets robbed, and he's attacked, and he's beaten, and everything he has is stolen. And he's left naked, laying in a ditch beside the road. And then the first person passes him, and the first person, I can't remember the exact order, but one of them is a very, very important religious person, and he passes him. And another person is a very important, let's say, a government person, and he passes him. And another person is a very important priest, and he passes him. And then along comes this regular guy who's maybe considered lesser in society, and he sees him there, takes pity on him, picks him up, takes him home, takes care of him. Okay, so this is the story of the Good Samaritan. Now, according to Rand and those people that are in that train of thought among libertarians, the Good Samaritan was an idiot. He was a fool. He was a sucker because he did this. And from the point of view of a Randian, those who walked on by, who maybe moved to the other side of the road and just looked the other way and walked on by, were doing the logical thing. The problem with that is that, and Mises goes into this to a certain extent. Rothbard has talked about it further. I think Walter Block, if I recall, Walter Block makes the best argument on this. I may be confusing him with something Rothbard said. Again, I wish I was at my computer at home. I would look this up and put it in. But anyway, but here's the thing. When a person does something good for someone else, it's not just because you're a sucker. It's because you get a certain amount of self-satisfaction out of the good feeling you get by helping someone. We help people because we feel good about it. It's a self-reward thing. In the story of the Good Samaritan, he didn't help the guy so he could get rewarded later. It was not a profit-loss thing. It was a profit in the sense that he made a profit emotionally to himself by giving of himself and helping someone else. Now, that's not a required thing. Jesus didn't say in the story, well, okay, now that priest is going to go to hell because of this. Or he didn't say in the story that respected holy man should be stoned to death because he left the guy laying in the ditch. Jesus didn't say that stuff. As a matter of fact, he didn't condemn those others at all. All he did was recognize the guy who did good. Now, there's a lesson in that alone, but I'm just going to focus on the fact that the individual who helped the guy, there was an internal reward in that. It made him feel good. Why do you go and grab a cold beer on a hot day, and you're out there mowing your yard in the sun, and it's blistering hot, and you just finish, and you go back, and you grab a cold beer, and you sit down in the shade, and you pop it open, and you drink your cold beer? Why do you do that? Because it makes you feel good. So when the Samaritan helped the man in the ditch, he did it because it made him feel good. That's why humans help each other. because we reap an immediate reward and we reap a long-term reward. That's what real civilization is based on, because humans profit by helping each other. Even if they don't profit financially, they profit emotionally from it. So there's this motivation to always help someone else because it helps you. So then, in self-ownership, we don't have to reject the concept of helping someone else. In self-ownership, we can not only own ourselves and recognize our own property and protect our own property and work for the profit of ourselves, but we can also help others because that helps us. Okay, so self-ownership, or the sovereignty of the individual. Well, let's go back to Wikipedia. Wikipedia says about self-ownership, it says it's the concept of property in one's own person expressed as the moral or natural right of a person to be the exclusive controller of his own body and life. Okay, now that's pretty good. That's a pretty good example. This is based on the idea that the individual owns themselves. Now, this should be too obvious to have to make a case for. If I don't own me, then what could I possibly own? And if I don't own anything, then of what value am I as an individual? If I don't even own myself, and if I can't own anything else, then how can anything have any value? Because I myself have no value. So self-ownership is the most natural and the most easily understood aspect of natural law. So once we have self-ownership, then we say, well, then if we have self-ownership, which is sovereignty, which is individual sovereignty, if we have self-ownership, individual sovereignty, then how can someone else have sovereignty over us? How can I own me and someone else own me at the same time? If I have a bottle of water, can I own that water and someone else own that water at the same time? Let's find out. I have a bottle of water here, and I own it. Now, one thing I can do with my bottle of water, since I own it, is take a drink of it. And there I took a drink of it. But if someone else owns it, I can't take a drink of it. Because by taking a drink of it, I've taken away some of its value, some of its content. And the other person has no ability to get that back, at least not in a usable form. At least not for drinking water, anyway. So it's clearly obvious that the individual does own something. As a matter of fact, I'm going to take another drink here for demonstration. All right, listen carefully. I'm taking another drink of water. Now, the water that was in the bottle is now in my stomach. Could it be argued that someone else other than me owns that water? Of course not. Technically, it's already started to become a part of me. Therefore, I own it. And I can't be separated from it. Well, eventually I will, but you know what I mean. So then, if I own something, no one else can own it at the same time. And if I own my body, no one else can own it at the same time. That being the case, and if I can own a property like this bottle of water, and if no one else can own it at the same time, then no one has the right to take it away from me if I have the right to own it. Therefore, no one has the right to tax me or rob me or in any other way take something from me that I don't want to give up. So then we go back to the Occupy folks, back to the Occupy DC, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Atlanta, Occupy whatever. Clearly, they're not operating with an understanding of natural rights. Clearly, they're not operating with an understanding of individual sovereignty. And clearly, they're not operating in any way that's going to produce anything in the long term that's not based on theft and aggression and lies. What they are developing within their little groups of consensus democracy is just another form of the state. So they would like to look at the fascist system that we have, with the corporations and the banksters making all this money off the sweat of the workers, of the lower class people, of the people who are actually making a living. Jobs being destroyed through this sucking of wealth away from the lower and middle classes. And what they want to bring to us is just a different form of the state. More of the same, just with a slightly different flavor to it, a different flair, but it's still the violence of the state. You can't escape the violence that's inherent in the system if the system is based on the state. Even if you have an agreement among all of these people to have the aggression of the state, the individual who's being aggressed upon, if they're sane, are not going to be a part of that consensus. And therefore, you're aggressing on individual sovereignty. So I hope that makes sense. I hope you can see what I'm trying to lay out there is the difference between the mistakes that were made in the founding of the U.S. Government back in the late 1700s. The mistake that people like Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau, the mistake that they made, and Franklin, in attempting to justify the state as being legitimate by the consent of the governed. Because there can be no consent of the governed. The minute the very act of being a state requires that somebody has to be aggressed upon. You can't have a monopoly of a geographic monopoly of aggression if there's no one who's aggressed upon. It's kind of like, I don't even know what to compare it to, the concept's so goofy. So whoever's being aggressed upon certainly doesn't consent. So you can't have the consent of the governed if the governed are being aggressed upon. And the state is based on the aggression. So it becomes an oxymoron. You can't have both. They're self-contradictive. The concepts are self-contradictive. Of being a state based on the consent of the people, if the consent of the people is required and the state is defined as that which is the aggressor. So I hope you can see what I'm trying to get at there, and I hope that you can see the flaw that's in the Occupy folks and their inability to come up with anything new. They think they're doing something new. They really think this. But really, it's the same old devil. It's the same old socialism. It's the same old concept that if we just, shine this up a little and put a different twist on it, that we're going to have something other than the state. But it's not. It's still the same state. It's still the same socialism, and it's the same oppression. And the only way, the only answer, is to break away from that and get to individual sovereignty, where an individual self-ownership is recognized and the right of property of the individual is respected. And we return to natural law as we were designed to be in the first place and as we were designed to have in the first place. And when we return to that, these side issues of corporations using the aggression of the state to rob the people, all those things disappear when you eliminate the state and you eliminate the aggression of the state and you eliminate that which gives one corporation the advantage over other companies or other corporations. All that vanishes, and then you have just the peaceful, free exchange of the marketplace where... And I say free exchange, I don't mean no money is exchanging hands. I mean the free exchange in the sense that there's no aggression involved. And when there's no aggression involved in the marketplace is a free market. And then you have prosperity. And that's natural. That's natural law. That's the natural state of man, is the free market. And respect of rights and respect of property, respect of individual property rights. Well, thanks a lot, folks, for listening. For more on property rights, the zero aggression principle, and liberty, go to badquaker.com. Thank you.